As I mentioned just before, I'm new in the role of advocacy manager at the Trust. I just took this role on at the end of last year, so it's really exciting to be able to travel to the countryside and to meet all of the historical societies and people like you that are doing work on the ground that really makes such a big difference in the preservation and celebration of our heritage. So thank you so much for having me here today. I would also like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land where we're meeting, the Tungurung people. And we pay respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and recognise that they were the first people of Australia. So how many of you, just a show of hands, are members of the National Trust? Oh, great. Hopefully I'll do some converting as well while I'm here today. So I'll talk to you a little bit first about the work that the National Trust does. So many of you will be familiar with the iconic properties that we have, like Rip and Lee and Como, and the fantastic house museums that we run, and the education programs that we provide at places like the Old Melbourne Jail and the Pollywood site. But we also have a very active advocacy arm, which was really the genesis of the National Trust when it formed in the 1950s and continues to be at the heart of what the National Trust does today. So the National Trust is a community-based and, very importantly, non-government organisation which is committed to promoting and conserving Australia's Indigenous, natural and historic heritage through advocacy work and the custodianship of heritage places and objects. The National Trusts across Australia, and there are chapters in each state, are the only conservation organisations in Australia concerned with all aspects of our heritage, including natural, cultural, tangible and intangible. And on our team, we have a small dedicated team of advocacy experts, like myself and my colleagues, who work to advance the protection of heritage places across Victoria, including buildings, trees and landscapes. The way that we advocate is by consulting, and Mark spoke really well about the importance of engaging with the communities that value the heritage that you're looking at, whether that be an Aboriginal community or a local community like the Historical Society. And that's why we really value these opportunities to connect with your groups to find out more about what's important to you and how we can help you to protect it. We also communicate about our heritage and through our media profile and our publications. We've got some free copies of our quarterly magazine at the back that you're free to take home with you today. We try and tell stories and celebrate our heritage and also ensure that people are aware of some of the challenges that are being faced so that we can mobilise the community to protect our heritage. As an independent body, we also have a really important role to lobby decision makers, whether that be at local government, state government, or federal government level. And we also like to collaborate with fellow heritage and history professionals in order to create a really rigorous research base for the work that we do to ensure that it's informed and that it's correct. So Mark has spoken about the Aboriginal Heritage Act, which is one of the key pieces of legislation that protects heritage in Victoria. So I'm going to touch on a few of the other pieces of legislation that we operate within. And for any of you that have had experience engaging with the planning system at a local or state government level, you'll know that it's a quagmire. It's very complicated. There are lots of pieces of legislation that run in parallel, and it can be quite daunting and sometimes a little bit frustrating for people who want to engage in the system. That's why the National Trust exists. That's why we have qualified people on staff to help you to navigate that process. So at a state level, the highest level of protection is provided by the Heritage Act 1995, which has just undergone a comprehensive review and which I'll talk about in a moment. So that identifies and administrates places of significance to the state of Victoria. It's a very high threshold of significance. And those places are listed on the Victorian Heritage Register. At a local level, heritage is protected under the Planning and Environment Act, and that's what allows councils to establish heritage overlays to protect local heritage places in the planning scheme. At a national level, heritage is protected under the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Act. So that's a very broad-ranging act which covers natural and historic heritage and is really concerned with places of national significance. So the key agencies, we've already heard about Aboriginal Victoria, which is one of the really the key agencies, as well as the Aboriginal Heritage Council. The other key heritage agencies, as Mark said, are Heritage Victoria, which is a part of the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning, or the very elegant DELP, lovely name. So what that government department does is it makes recommendations to the Heritage Council about places that should be protected on the Victorian Heritage Register. It administrates the Victorian Heritage Register, so they process nominations and applications for changes to places on the Victorian Heritage Register. They administrate permits for those places. They provide funding at the moment under the Living Heritage Grants Program, which is currently open, and I would encourage you to look around and see if there are any local projects that you'd like to apply for. They also do compliance, so ensuring that owners of heritage places comply with the regulations associated with the development and management of heritage places. And they also do conservation and collection management. So the Heritage Council, like the Victorian Aboriginal Heritage Council, provides advice to the Minister for Planning. It's an independent statutory body, and it makes the final decision about places that are added to the Victorian Heritage Register. They also conduct hearings for registration and permit appeals, which are made to them. They also do some education and research around heritage and around advancing our understanding of heritage and our ability to manage that. So the Shared Values Project that was done in collaboration with the Aboriginal Heritage Council is a really great example of the innovative work that the Heritage Council does. So as I mentioned before, and I won't go into this in too much detail because it's quite dry, but there was recently a fairly comprehensive review of the Heritage Act undertaken, the first review that has been undertaken since the Act was gazetted in 1995. So this review was kicked off in 2015, and the Planning Minister introduced a bill to Parliament in 2016, following an extensive period of consultation and submissions, which introduced a number of key changes, mainly to reduce the regulatory burden of the Act and make it easier for Heritage Victoria to administrate it. The bill, which a very significant aspect of the bill, also strengthens Heritage Victoria's enforcement powers. It doubled the penalties for willful and negligent destruction of heritage places, which was great to see, and includes the provision for custodial sentences for negligence and willful destruction. But the National Trust has concerns that major deficiencies remain within the Act. So in particular, there's a lack of broad third-party appeal rights for permit decisions. So a really good example of that is Pentridge Prison. And many of you will have seen articles in The Age about the ongoing conflict there between the community and the developers and the scope of development that's happening at that site. The issue is that when a developer applies for a permit, if that permit is granted by Heritage Victoria, there is no opportunity for the community to appeal that decision. So locally, if you have a development where a permit's granted by the council, you can take that to VCAT if you want to challenge that. There's no such opportunity to challenge those decisions within the Heritage Act. So the National Trust did a lot of lobbying around this while the bill was being debated. We successfully got some amendments introduced to the Legislative Assembly which would have broadened third-party appeal rights, but unfortunately the appetite wasn't there to support that and they were voted down. So that's an area of reform that the National Trust would like to continue to pursue into the future to really try and empower the community to get involved in that decision-making process around places that are of state significance. So there was extensive debate in Parliament and lots of speeches by politicians about what heritage means to them and how important it is. So it was really great to see that support for heritage in Parliament. And the bill has now passed both houses and it will come into effect on the 1st of November. So Heritage Victoria are currently doing a lot of work to prepare for the implementation of that new legislation and developing new and updated regulations to operate around that. And the National Trust is involved in that process. So certainly we're very aware of the need to ensure that Heritage Victoria's processes are really well integrated with local government processes and that there's a more integrated approach to the protection of our heritage and that councils are involved in the state heritage process so that local voices have a say. So looking at heritage in Victoria, I'm sure that, you know, in a historic town like Kilmore, we're all pretty familiar with the really amazing 19th century heritage that we have here in Victoria and especially in this part of the state. But there are also some emerging areas, emerging heritage issues that we're looking at the National Trust. And the National Trust's role is really to push the boundaries about our understanding of heritage and how we manage it. So these are areas that we're really focusing on at the moment. So the first one is post-war heritage. So looking at this wonderful building that we're in today, this is a really great example of the fantastic post-war architecture that is often architecturally significant but not necessarily recognised yet as heritage in local heritage protections. So there's an increasing recognition across the heritage profession but also the community that post-war residential and civic architecture is really important. It's the next layer of our heritage that tells a story about our community, and it's a gap in local heritage protection that we need to fill by encouraging councils to review those aspects of our heritage. Social significance is also, and the intangible values that Mark was talking about before, is a really important emerging theme in heritage, and we're still trying to work out how you measure and recognise and protect social heritage values, but a couple of really high-profile examples of heritage campaigns in Melbourne have really highlighted this issue. So this photograph here, you may recognise that as the London Hotel, which until very recently was in Port Melbourne. The closest pub to Station Pier, which was the port and thoroughfare for many thousands of people travelling to Melbourne from overseas. And so this pub was a really important part of Melbourne's social history and social fabric. It was a 19th century pub that was remodelled in the 1930s. So when it was assessed, when the heritage advisor was doing the assessment of heritage in Port Melbourne, they looked at that pub and what they saw was the architecture. And they saw that the facade of that building was not original to its original 19th century form. Because of that, it was seen to not be of heritage significance because that change had happened over time. But what we understand now is that that change is actually what makes it significant. So places like this have reinvented themselves over time to fit in with fashions, to be places that people like to go and to gather. And they're also important because of the stories they tell and the communities that are associated with them. Unfortunately, it was not included in the heritage overlay for the City of Port Phillip, and a demolition permit was issued without even being referred to the heritage advisor of that council because it just wasn't on their radar at all. Then once the owner, who already had the demolition permit, put in the application for a apartment development on that site, the community was able to find out about that, and there was widespread, I guess, outrage and upset and sadness in the community that a place like this, that had been a place of social gathering for many, many decades, would come under threat from a private developer. Even though it was a privately owned building, it still had a really important public and social function. So there was a big community campaign, and the Port Melbourne Historical Society were a really big part of that campaign to protect that hotel. But and the council recognised the community's interest in this site and did commission a heritage report which found the pub to be of social significance. But unfortunately, when they asked the Minister for Planning for protection, he declined to offer that protection because the process was already in train, and there's a perception of not wanting to change the rules midstream because that is bad for investment and development. So it's a really sad story, and that pub has now been demolished, but it's a really great wake-up call for us to recognise those places that might be important to us but that don't have legal protection, and for us to take action to try and seek that protection before they become threatened. Another example is the Greyhound Hotel, which you may have seen the story in The Age yesterday, is currently being demolished as we speak. And so that's a community that's basically the same community as the London Hotel, and there's a lot of sadness in that community about that. This brings me to the biggest and most prominent heritage issue of last year and maybe even this year, which has really been a lightning rod for people's feelings and understanding of heritage and the pressure that our heritage is under from development. Sorry, I just want to go back to the last slide. And one thing I forgot to mention was the other thing that is an emerging issue in heritage, which is cultural landscapes. And Mark touched on that in his presentation. And it was also really interesting to hear Robert Macklin talking about Old Hume Highway 31, which is another really important cultural landscape. And what we're recognising now is that heritage places shouldn't necessarily be looked at in isolation, but as part of a bigger story. And if we recognise those places as groups and collections, we can have a more complex and full understanding of our history. So a recent example of this being recognised at a national level was the Burke, Wills, King and Yandrawonda National Heritage Place, which is in South Australia and Queensland and comprises five sites stretching along Cooper Creek in Queensland and South Australia, so across a very big area, but a series of sites that tell a really important story. We're also working with the Wurundjeri people on the Sunbury Rings landscape, which Mark spoke about. So this is a landscape that the most important value in that landscape is the incredible and very rare Aboriginal earth ring sites that are in that landscape. But it's also a really interesting colonial landscape because it's part of a bigger valley formation where you've got Emu Bottom, which is one of the first European settled sort of homestead complexes in Victoria, and also Rupertswood, which is a really significant 19th century place as well at the other end of the valley. So we're working with the Wurundjeri and the Victorian Planning Authority and the local community to try and work out the best way to protect that landscape and the complex story that it tells within the context of new suburban development and urban growth areas in Melbourne. So that will be one to watch over the next few months. So back to the Carlton Inn. This incident in October last year really galvanised both the community and government agencies around the protection and responsible development of heritage places. The outpouring of anger and grief from the community regarding the destruction of this building is unparalleled in our recent history, and it's raised a number of interesting issues. It also caused widespread reflection in the community about what it is that we value about heritage places, and also the continued destruction of our heritage, whether total like this and unlawful, or just incremental through development pressures that are increasingly facing our cities and suburbs and towns. Significantly, the demolition was the catalyst for long overdue increases in penalties for unlawful demolition under the Building Act, as well as the Heritage Act 1995. And the Minister for Planning acted very quickly in enacting those in Parliament. The state government and Melbourne Council are also taking the owners to VCAT and seeking an order for the pub to be restored to its condition prior to the demolition works. Whether or not that actually takes place and what form that should take is going to be the interesting outcome of this process. If you rebuild a pub that was there before, what do you have? Do you have the heritage values of that place, or do you just have a replica? I think it's a really interesting question about heritage and about how we respond to demolition. And I don't think there's any right or wrong answer to that. But the National Trust has played a pivotal role in bringing different community groups together to try and talk about that and talk about what people want. And I think that the key thing is that the community should really drive the outcome of what happens on this site, because this place has been taken away by a private owner who acted unlawfully. Yes. So just to give you an update on that VCAT process, because people ask me all the time, and it's ever-evolving and very complicated. So as I said, they're going to VCAT. That's being contested by the developers and the QCs that they have employed to make submissions on their behalf. And in March, just prior to a compulsory conference, which was ordered by VCAT to confidentially discuss the proposed plans for the site, the developers applied at the last minute for a stay of proceedings pending the outcome of the criminal proceedings that are also being levied against them in parallel. Happily, VCAT refused this request, so there will be a hearing which begins on the 31st of July. So that's coming up quite soon. And it's interesting to note that while there have been previous examples of unauthorised partial demolitions of heritage places, like things like walls or parts of buildings, the severity and brazen nature of this demolition is actually very rare. And so the response to this, in many ways, has been unprecedented. VCAT's ruling on this will therefore set an important precedent for the consequences of unlawful demolition, and we definitely look forward to the outcome of the hearing. So, in looking at heritage and advocacy in the National Trust role, that brings me to the question of why should historical societies get involved in advocacy? Many historical societies have fantastic collections, do great public programs, and do excellent research. But there's also this phenomenal potential to get involved as heritage advocates and actively campaign for the protection of our heritage, because you have the local knowledge, you have the resources and the ability to communicate those values that's such an important part of advocating for our heritage. So I really encourage you to get involved in the protection of heritage places and to work with the National Trust to do that, and we can provide support and advice for that. I think that as development pressures increase and urban sprawl is spreading outwards, I think that now we're seeing unprecedented pressure on our heritage places. So it's a really good time to step up and make sure that our local government and state government authorities are doing the right thing and are doing enough to protect our heritage. So here are some tips for getting involved in heritage advocacy. Whichever submission process that you engage in, whether that be planning permits, planning amendments, heritage permits, or additions to the register, your written and oral submissions will have a greater chance of success if you follow these pretty simple tips. First, be informed. Understand the specific terms of the application, amendment, or recommendation before you object. Within the specified deadline, look at all the documentation that's available for you, and that might require a visit to the local council. So feel free to get friendly with your local council planners, who can really provide you with the background information you need and step you through the process. Be timely. This is important. All public submission processes operate to deadlines, and the initial submission period is always the key to securing your right to object further down the track, even if it's just a simple letter. In some instances, you might be able to get involved later down the track if you missed your opportunity, but you'll have to demonstrate that you have an interest in that process. So save yourself time and meet the initial deadline. Be concise, and this is sometimes one of the most difficult things for historians, and I'm a historian, to do, because we love historical details and we're really passionate about the intricacies and complexities of our history. But a concise and well-argued submission will always stand out. So get to the point. What's really important about the argument that you're making and the place that you're defending? So be ruthless about editing out minor arguments which may detract from your main point. And if it helps, include a more comprehensive history as an appendix to your submission. Be strategic. Your objective is to convince the relevant council, state department, or statutory body to adopt your submission. But their objective might be different, and that is to balance your arguments against conflicting considerations. In many cases, there'll be lots of issues that need to be considered, including heritage, but also the needs for growth and all of the other objectives that we need to meet in our society. An objection which demonstrates a thoughtful compromise can go partway to helping decision makers craft a solution and is therefore more likely to succeed. So consider whether you can propose a compromise. And the most important point to remember is be prepared to persist. Planning processes are very long and sometimes very complicated. They're also incredibly tedious and tiring, but it's really important to persist because you can triumph if you stick with it. If you pursue your objection past the first public submission phase and possibly all the way to an application at VCAT or the Heritage Council, you'll inevitably have to rewrite your submission several times, but it's worth it. So in preparing a submission, briefly describe how you will be impacted or how your community will be impacted by the development and relate those effects directly to the current proposal. Go beyond your personal interest and explain how the place is important to the community. Be succinct, non-personable, and reasonable. Submit by the deadline. And if it's a local council issue, I really encourage you to follow up your submission with a verbal submission at a council meeting when it comes up on the agenda. In my experience, councillors always appreciate when people in the community take the time to communicate directly with them. And I have been successful in changing a few minds on the nights of council meetings thanks to verbal submissions, so you never know what you can achieve. Lobby your decision makers from local councillors to members of parliament. And how do you keep abreast of heritage issues? The National Trust and becoming a member of the National Trust provides you with an opportunity to stay in touch with our regular email newsletters and magazines, which contain lots of information about campaigns that we're working on. But we're just three people in an office and we can't be everywhere and know everything. So contact us if there is an issue and don't assume that we will be aware of it. make submissions in writing to relevant planning authorities. So don't just call up and speak to them on the phone. Make sure you put your argument in writing so that there's a paper trail and that it will be formally part of the process. Notify your members, the members of your historical society, and encourage them to make submissions in writing too, because the more voices that you have, the more powerful they are. Organise a petition to demonstrate support. This can be really effective, especially when you can put some time and effort into really promoting it and getting as many signatures as you can. And there are lots of really great online platforms now, like change.org, that provide a really quick and easy way to get people involved and to share on your Facebook pages and social media. And also, and this should not be underestimated, be proactive and celebrate the places you care about. Because sometimes by the time you become aware that something's under threat, it might be too late to save it. The National Trust team is currently developing an advocacy toolkit that will have guidelines like these, as well as other practical tips for writing submissions that will be available to download on our website later this year. So just to finish, I wanted to give you a case study of a really excellent campaign that was run by a historical society in Melbourne, the Caulfield Historical Society, Glenira Historical Society, sorry. So this humble building here is the only remaining building on the Caulfield Hospital site with associations going back to World War I, which was when the hospital was founded. It was built in 1916 entirely by funds raised by the local community and was an outpatient home for World War I soldiers, providing support, comfort and friendship for recovering soldiers. The men who returned from war here were able to use this place to learn valuable skills to help them re-enter the community. It opened in the grounds of the Australian General Military Hospital No. 11 in 1916, after the government had purchased a mansion on this site to open a repatriation hospital. At the time, the Argus described it as a handsome new rest home and a gift of Caulfield citizens, and it was run by the Red Cross. So this building, it's very humble, and walking past this building, you might not think twice about it because it kind of looks like a house. It's got those wide verandas. But once you actually delve into the history of it, you really discover that it's an extraordinary place. It's very rare in our history and a really important place to protect. So you can see a photo of it now down here, and you can see that it hasn't really changed that much since 1916. And actually, it's currently being used as a nursing home, so it's still being used for that original use that it was built for in the first place. So in 2015, the Historical Society became aware of a new development proposed at the hospital for an aged care facility that would threaten this humble building that no one really knew much about. But they knew it was special, and so they looked into it a bit more, and they discovered some of the amazing stories that had come out of this place. So I'll just tell you the story of Bernard Haynes, who's the soldier up in the middle panel there, who, while an extraordinary story, is also a kind of typical experience for men who returned from World War I, and for whom this place was really important. So this is a picture of Bernard in 1916. He enlisted in the military at age 14 and sailed with the 29th Infantry Brigade of the AIF. After just 2 years of service, he was seriously wounded in France in 1917. It was necessary to amputate one of his legs before he came back to Australia, and he spent 8 years here at the Caulfield Military Hospital before dying after his 41st operation. So listening to that story, you can really imagine the important place that this had following World War I. It was the biggest repatriation hospital in Victoria. It was a place where men from all over Victoria came to be receive medical treatment and also to recuperate after their experiences, suffering physical and mental trauma. Many of them stayed there for many years and many of them died there. So it's a place of really important social history. And I think as people who are interested in history, we're all aware that the commemoration of war and conflict is very much an important part of Australia's culture and history. But we often neglect to look at the really tangible examples of that history that we still have existing today that might not be grand mansions or examples of amazing architecture, but actually tell a really important story about that war history. So as I said, the Glen Eira Historical Society became aware that this place was under threat. And they embarked on a two-year, three-year process to campaign for its protection. So I've just done a little flowchart here to kind of indicate the different levels of campaigning that they went through. And when they embarked on this journey, they would never have known how long it would take and how much work it would take. And I'm glad they didn't know that, because I'm glad they did it. But it goes to show that if you persist and you really engage in the process, that you can have a good outcome. So the first thing that they tried to do was to negotiate with the developer. The National Trust, they approached the National Trust and we said that, yes, we'd like to support this campaign. And we attended some meetings with the developer to try and get them to save this building. They said it couldn't be done, and they said, really interesting history, thank you for telling us about this. We really value the importance of this place, but there's just no way that we can keep this building. We have to demolish it, but we'll build a memorial poppy garden instead. So we didn't think that was good enough. So what the Glen Eira Historical Society did was to nominate it to the Victorian Heritage Register to try and get protection at a state level. So in 2016, that application was accepted, and it was then recommended for inclusion on the register. This was then appealed by the developer and also by the hospital, because they didn't want that encumbrance on their development. So it led to a hearing, which happened in October last year. So this was about 18 months later, where the Heritage Council convened to hear all of the arguments for and against. And the developer brought expert witnesses and had lawyers to make their submissions. The Historical Society stood up and gave their account of the history of this place and really spoke to the heart of why it's important to the community. And the National Trust also made a submission in support as well. And then in March this year, we received news that the Heritage Council had upheld the decision to include it on the Victorian Heritage Register. So the building was saved. So it was a really wonderful outcome after a really challenging process. But it showed the power of historical societies as representatives of the community and keepers of local knowledge to really protect and band together to protect our heritage. So I'll leave you with that. It was a pleasure working with this group, and I learned a lot about our history and really enjoyed the process of working with them. And I really encourage you to join the National Trust, to become members so that you stay in the loop with everything that we're doing, and to get in touch if you need help to navigate this sometimes complex and daunting process.